Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. The release of Stanley Nelson's new documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, could not be more timely. Next year marks the 50th anniversary of the formation of the group that called itself the Black Panther Party for Social Defense when it began as a local response to police brutality in Oakland, California. It soon became a national organization and served both as a vehicle for social programs and as a group whose goal was nothing less than the overthrow of the United States government. Recent events in Ferguson, Baltimore, Staten Island, and elsewhere suggest that the issues that sparked the Black Panther movement remain relevant today. The film opens tomorrow at Film Forum on West Houston Street and brings Stanley Nelson to our show today, along with former Panther Kathleen Cleaver. Kathleen, welcome back to our show.
Thank you so very much.
Let's begin with you, Stanley. How much did you know about the Black Panther Party when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I knew a little bit, probably no more than anybody else. I was 15 or so when the Panthers came into being. I was living in New York City, and so they were something of great interest. You know, they were talking about issues that were of concern to me and to us in New York. You know, but also they had that look. You know, they looked so cool. So the Panthers were something that I naturally gravitated to.
They were a group, Kathleen, that understood branding fairly early, the berets, the black leather jackets. We've lost Kathleen.
I can answer that question. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that the Panthers were great at was that kind of branding and that look that so intrigued people.
Even giving themselves the name Panther.
Yeah, I mean that it all was part of publicity. The Panthers were great at getting on the news, and that's something to really understand that the Panthers were kind of media darlings.
And Kathleen, I just asked you about the branding aspect, the look of the Panthers. Was that one of the attractions?
It was the view that we had of Algerians and Cubans and how they looked in their uniforms and their berets, and we wanted that revolutionary vanguard look.
What was the legal statute that the Panthers took advantage of while they were going about their neighborhood patrols in Oakland?
In California, there was no laws concerning the carrying of weapons. There were fish and game laws, and you were allowed to carry weapons openly as long as you didn't have a live round in the chamber. So they took advantage of that and carried weapons openly in the formation of patrols and followed the police.
Did the NRA comment on their right to openly carry weapons at the time?
I have no idea. I don't remember hearing anything about the NRA in 1966 or 7 when the Black Panther Party started their patrols. They started in...
I think that one thing that was so fascinating about the Panthers was very soon on, California moved to kind of change those laws because of the Panthers and say, wait a minute, you know, maybe we shouldn't allow you to carry open loaded weapons in California.
So that led to the Mulford Act, and the Panthers showed up at the state capitol?
Yeah, one of the huge events for the Panthers was that they showed up in the state capitol in Sacramento with their weapons, with loaded weapons, and kind of by accident found themselves on the floor of the California state legislature. And one of the most amazing things was that Ronald Reagan, who was the governor of California at the time, just happened to be having a news conference on the lawn outside. And when the reporters saw the Panthers, they just gravitated to the Panthers. And this is what kind of put the Panthers for the first time on the national stage.
Kathleen, what were the issues that made up the 10-point program that the Black Panther Party issued? They called it What We Want Now.
What We Want, What We Believe. It was modeled on the platform and program of another organization, but we had our points. The first point was we want power to determine the destiny of our black community, and then what we believe, and then it went on, we want an end to the large number of black men in jail. We wanted end to police brutality and murder of black people. We wanted decent education. We wanted shelter fit for human beings. It was a social justice platform. And the last point we called for was we wanted a United Nations plebiscite for Black people to determine whether or not they wanted to be citizens or not. And so we had a program that was basic, it was practical, and it was radical simultaneously.
And what led you to decide to join the Black Panthers? How old were you?
I was asked to come and help Eldridge Cleaver shortly after Huey Newton was shot in an incident in Oakland, and he had a bullet in his stomach, and he was put in jail and facing the death penalty. I was a SNCC organizer at the time, and I had met Eldridge at a conference. And when Huey went into the hospital, there was only a handful of Panthers. Bobby Seale was doing time because of the Sacramento visit. The office had been lost. They had kind of gone through a collapse. And he just said, you've got to come out here and help me.
Wasn't Eldridge already a controversial figure because he was a convicted rapist?
No. Eldridge was an ex-convict who was not publicly part of the Black Panther Party. He was secretly part because of his parole status. He may have been controversial, but not because of his association with the Black Panthers. But once the leader of the Black Panthers was facing the death penalty and the chairman was in jail, he was the person who felt that he had to take the responsibility for making sure everything happened to prevent Huey from going to the gas chamber. And he asked me to help him. We were in love. We were engaged. I came out to California in November. We got married in December. And we continued and worked together until Huey was out of jail and until the party was over.
That was
even beyond that.
Of course, one of the first big campaigns was the Free Huey movement. Although the circumstances that led to his being sent to jail still remain kind of cloudy. He had been in jail before for stabbing somebody.
I'm not sure if he had been in jail before he was in jail after, but there was an incident and a police officer was shot. Huey was shot. He went to jail again, as Kathleen said. He was, it was a possibility that he was tried for murder, but he was eventually acquitted. So,
and then there was a split between Eldridge and Huey.
I think you should call it an expulsion. There was a denunciation of some of the things that had happened in the party on behalf of Eldridge, and he suggested that instead of expelling certain key individuals and groups in New York and California, that instead David Huey would be expelled because he was running the party. He made that comment, and he wanted Huey to implement those changes. He wanted others reinstated, and Huey was flummoxed, he was embarrassed, and he was furious.
One of the things
Eldridge after that.
Yeah, one of the things that we should say is that this was all on a TV show. Eldridge is in Algeria, Huey is in Oakland, and it's on a TV show, and we have the tape of that TV show, and then also when Huey calls back and expels Eldridge and the whole international wing at the same time, calling them punks and other things.
Well, he was in Algeria, but he had gone to Cuba, then Algeria, then France. What were the circumstances?
At that time, no France. At that time, we were in Algeria. We had an international section. We were part of a very broad-ranging activist movement in Africa and in Europe and plugged into the United States. So,
did he have to leave the country?
After some other incidents, it really had nothing to do with Huey Newton and the expulsion. It had to do with a couple of hijackings that came to Algeria from African Americans who wanted to come and join us, and they hijacked planes. After that, the Algerian government was no longer interested in our presence, and they asked us to leave.
Now, Eldridge returned to the United States in 1975, became involved in religious groups like Reverend Moon's Unification Church and the Mormons, and became a conservative Republican. Had he totally rejected his earlier goals with the Panthers?
What I will say...
Were you married to him at the time still?
Yes. Uh-huh. What I will say is I believe that Eldridge Cleaver suffered, as many people have, who end up claiming that the identity of a born-again Christian, I believe that he suffered a nervous breakdown and that his personality changed. Or we saw another aspect of his personality that wasn't evident when he was in the Black Panther Party when he became the born-again Christian. That's what I say.
My guests are Kathleen Cleaver and Stanley Nelson, who's the writer and director of a film called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It opens tomorrow at Film Forum here on West Houston Street. Stanley, how did the Black Panther Party recruit members?
You know, I think that, that the members of the Black Panther Party, by and large, were self-recruiting. You know, as
we talk about
in this after the Sacramento adventure, I'll call it, you know, and the Panthers make this national news. We interviewed some people who joined the Panthers, and one guy says, you know, I wanted to be part of that, whatever that was.
And then it wound up, people started doing that all over the country.
Yeah, I think that, that what happened was, you know, a lot of people's experience were experiences all over the country were negative in regards to the police, a lot of African Americans, and they began to join the Panthers. I think that one of the things that, that we say in the film, and I think Kathleen is actually the one who says it, is that in some ways the Panther Party grew too fast, and it got so big so fast. This was, you know, the Panthers were a local movement in Oakland, and all of a sudden it just explodes like wildfire and takes off all over the country.
Was it seen in many people's minds as an alternative to the to Martin Luther King and SNCC and some of the less aggressive civil rights groups?
No, but it's not that. It's that the circumstances in the Deep South that Martin Luther King was facing dealt with segregation and exclusion from public facilities, et cetera. That's not part of the North. Social conditions like housing, police brutality, bad schooling. But the conditions were different, and that was why the Panther Party appealed in the North, whereas King's solutions were for problems that people didn't seem to face in the North.
Did the Panthers see an opportunity to join with predominantly white groups like SDS that were had similar goals, and, for example, anti-war
Eldridge
goals?
Cleaver was the person who initiated what we called coalitions and alliances with white radical groups. That was not necessarily the desire or goal of everyone in the Black Panther Party, but there was a political choice that, and a political decision that Eldridge Cleaver, as one of the leaders, made to do that.
I think that one of the things that, that we see in the film very clearly, visually, is that the Panthers were aligned with other groups, and that, you know, you see Eldridge Cleaver speaking or Bobby Seale speaking, and the audience is 90% white. There's a great speech that Bobby Seale makes in the film where he says, you know, we are not against anybody, any one group. We don't hate white people. We hate aggression. We hate what the police are doing to our people.
Now, there were a number of different aspects of the Panthers. There was the Panthers Free Lunch Program.
Breakfast.
And at this, was there a tension between the two prongs, the people who ran the social programs and the ones dedicated to the overthrow of the U.S. government?
Let's put it this way. Bobby Seale was the person who initiated the breakfast program. He had the positioning. He said, listen, the FBI is all over us. The police are attacking us. They are doing this. They're doing that. We have to do something that shows another aspect of our programs. And they started in churches free breakfast for school children. And he had a son who said, if children go to school hungry, they don't learn. And so it was a responding to a social problem, but also attempting to deflect some of the hostility and violence.
I think one of the important things, though, to understand and remember is J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, said that the most disturbing and dangerous part of the Black Panther Party was the Breakfast for Children program. So even as the party says, okay, let's do something else, let's just serve some kids breakfast, they kind of get ostracized for that.
How effective was the FBI's COINTELPRO program? The reason that
this way, it hasn't ended. There are people still serving time, people dying in prison from that COINTELPRO program. There's still people going around with their minds blasted because of the stress they did. So J. Edgar Hoover is dead and buried, but the legacy of the attacks and things that were done to people under COINTELPRO, particularly the murders, the young leaders who were murdered in UCLA in 1969.
And then later Fred Hampton. J. Edgar Hoover was determined that no black messiah would rise from the Black Panther Party. And is that one of the reasons he saw the breakfast program as a threat?
Well, he saw the breakfast program as a threat because he saw it as indoctrinating young minds. You know, not only are you serving breakfast, but you're now indoctrinating young minds. And I think that, as Kathleen said, you know, we have to understand how effective these programs were, and that one of the things we were able to do in the film were to obtain FBI documents and to use those FBI documents to where you actually see what the FBI said and did to destroy the Panthers.
Now, although women made up the majority of the rank and file of the Panthers. Alice Walker has been highly critical of what she saw as sexism in the party. Was she right?
You know what? Sexism was rampant in the United States.
I think we lost you. Well, I could try to finish her thought, and I think the Panthers were reflective of what we're seeing in the United States. I think that in a lot of ways, the Panthers were also, you know, very advanced in having women as spokespeople, have women as leaders. But there's also something that happened. The film really covers 1966 to 73, and there were some horrible things that happened to women, you know, in the party, kind of after that period, as the Panther Party starts to deteriorate.
Now, why did it fall apart? Many of the problems the Panthers addressed remain issues in America today.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. You know, you had this kind of split between Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton. And some people followed Eldridge, some people followed Huey. And then a great number of people said, you know, I didn't join this thing to be in the middle of this fight. I'm just going to drop out. You had the FBI kind of attacking the Panthers from without, police departments attacking the Panthers from without. It was almost like you would be crazy to join the Black Panther Party when you knew that this was happening. And it's also imploding from within with the personalities are fighting each other.
And there were a number of informants who were in all of the different branches of the party.
Right. Well, the party was riddled with informers. You know, I think nobody clearly understood, you know, how much the party was riddled by these informers. Nobody knew. And so, you know, you had informers in the leadership, you had informers in the rank and file, you had informers all over.
Kathleen, do you think that Black Lives Matter is kind of a version of what the Panthers were doing?
You know, I am overwhelmingly perplexed. Black Lives Matter has made a commitment to nonviolence. Black Lives Matter works primarily with large demonstrations and other types of groups. The Black Panther Party was a cadre organization started with a minister of defense and a chairman with a 10-point platform and program, recruited people and became chapters of an organization, structured organization. It's not anything like Black Lives Matter, and Black Lives Matter is not anything like the Black Panther Party. What's the same is the problem of police murder of black people. They're facing the same problem. They're using very different methods.
Stanley Nelson will be holding Q&As during the week of September 2nd and September 15th at Film Forum. For event details, check out our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to Stanley Nelson, who is the writer-director of Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, which opens tomorrow at Film Forum, and to Kathleen Cleaver, who is one of the key figures in the story. Thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much
for having us.
You'd be hard-pressed to meet anyone who hears the names Big Bird, Elmo, Grover, Oscar the Grouch, and doesn't crack a smile as they remember their favorite characters from Sesame Street. But fans are likely to remember a number of real-life people just as fondly. And Sonia Manzano, better known as Maria, the owner of the Fix-It Shop, is definitely one of them. She retired this past June after 44 years on the show with 15 Emmy Awards for television writing. And she's also been recognized as one of the most influential Hispanic Americans in the United States. Now, Sonia Manzano has written her second book called Becoming Maria, Memoir of Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. It tells the story of her upbringing and the beginnings of a life spent making a difference for children. It is published by who's publishing this?
Scholastic.
a publisher that thinks a lot about kids. Sonia, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, your first book, The Revolution of Evelyn Serrano, is a novel. This book begins with some of your earliest memories and ends the moment before you begin working on Sesame Street. Do you plan to write another one?
Maybe. I have a couple ideas rumbling around in my head.
Not about your time on the show?
Yes, about my time on the show, but certainly more my personal view of my time on the show, and not less about the show and more about me.
Why did you feel that the story of this part of your life needed to be told?
Well, a bunch of reasons. The show started producing less segments while it expanded the cast humans and puppets, and so there was less work to go around. I have a lot of creative energy, and I needed some place to put it, so I decided to put it in writing.
So when you first started and there was a need for people to do everything, and you are writing and appearing on the show,
you
had a lot less time on you.
Yes, less so. And I love the form. I love the memoir form. I always have.
In thinking about the Puerto Rican neighborhood in the South Bronx that you grew up in, did you go back there to see whether it's changed much?
Well, since this book has been published, I've been back quite a few times with journalists, and it has. It's not there. It's barren. The Third Avenue used to be like Hester Street in the Lower East Side. There were millions of people. And now there's nobody there.
Well, there used to be an L there. And when they knocked down the Third Avenue L in Manhattan, it actually created a boom on that street. But it didn't have the same effect when they knocked
it down
in the Bronx?
Not in the Bronx, thanks to Robert Moses. And he cut the Bronx up with the Cross Bronx Expressway and isolated those neighborhoods. And then they took the L down and no one could get in or out. When I was there, I could be down on Orchard Street in like half an hour eating a knish. if people can't move out of their neighborhoods, if they need a car, I think it ghettoizes neighborhoods, and that's why these neighborhoods are empty now.
Chatham Square used to be so important because it was kind of a hub for that L.
Yeah.
Although there's a lot of sadness in the stories that you tell about growing up, you managed to convey it through the eyes and mind of a child. Did working on Sesame Street give you insights on how to write it that way?
No, I think I was born with this sensibility of remembering everything that happened to me before I was 7 years old. It was a wondrous time for me. And I think Sesame Street had that sensibility as well. And that's a reason I was so drawn to the show.
Did your parents move here from Puerto Rico?
Yes, they came separately. They met in New York.
And that's where you were born.
Yes, I was born in New York.
And John Oliver recently criticized members of the news media for referring to Puerto Ricans who've moved to the mainland as immigrants.
Right. We're not immigrants. We've been citizens since the Jones Act of 1921, as a matter of fact. But it's
which
still
is before your parents came here.
Yes.
You open the book with a story about your aunt and uncle moving to New York with their family, and you make it sound as though it was a kind of a thoughtless decision, something just on the spur of the moment. Was that typical?
Yes, I think that it makes me understand how desperate their situation was. I did a lot of research for Evelyn Serrano, and I read a lot about what was going on in Puerto Rico during the Depression. It makes Oliver Twist's childhood sound like a walk in the park. So they were very desperate people, and when somebody says, come on over, we've got a room for you, they came.
Well, right now, Puerto Rico is going through a rough economic time.
It sure is.
Have you been speaking to people about the desperate situation there today?
Actually, I don't have that much of a connection with folks in Puerto Rico anymore because they've passed on.
Much of your early years were defined by the abusive behavior of your father. What effect did that have on you?
Well, obviously, it put me in fight mode for a lot of my adult life, which I'm finally relaxing out of. I think that kids in that situation do get into a fight mode. But I was never the target. It was always my mother. It was seeing their relationship that was, I think, challenging.
Do you have any idea why he was so angry?
No, but I think that it must have come from the poverty that they went through in Puerto Rico, where children were abandoned, where children would hang around a house if they were thrown a crust of bread. I think living that harsh childhood makes you a harsh adult.
You write about a lethargy that came over you in your early years. Was that the result of what you were witnessing?
Yes.
Distancing yourself from it all?
Yes, I slept all the time. And when I went to visit a teacher who knew me at that time, she was the one who said to me, boy, were you a depressed kid? And I realized it in retrospect that I was. There was something to all of that sleeping I was doing.
And was that the teacher who asked you to ask your mother about her life?
No, Mr. Gitterman was the teacher who said told me that my mother should read to me. And my mother said, we have no books. And the teacher said, ask her to tell you stories about her life. That was a wonderful teacher. He introduced me to Charlotte's Web.
But you got more than you bargained for when you asked your mother that. What did she say?
Oh, my goodness. She would tell me these horrible stories about her childhood and having to care for children who would fall through the holes in the wooden shacks they lived in and drown in the sewage that ran under the houses.
And after you were overwhelmed by that, you asked her to tell you a story that she'd made up off the top of her head.
Right.
And
right.
her response must have seemed overwhelming to for a preteen to have
right,
to deal with.
Right. She said, well, there was a poor mother who lived in Crotona Park, and her husband beat her every day. But then her children grew up and they saved her. Happy? That was the end of that story. Well, so thanks, Ma.
But that must have stayed with you because you actually try to make that happen.
It did stay with me. So people should be aware of the clues that they give to children might be seriously picked up by them.
My guest is Sonia Manzano, who's written a memoir called Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. You got your mother to finally leave your father and divorce him.
Yes.
Then she kept on returning. Why do you think people return to abusive relationships?
I don't know. I think love is strange. I think there was some need in each of them that they fulfilled in each other. I have asked them as adults, and they have no satisfactory answer.
Your father as well?
Yes,
he couldn't tell you why he was always hitting
you? Well, you know, life stuff happens. She always wanted to do what she wanted. I love her. You know, and my mother's response was, well, I always thought that when you'd grow up, you'd understand. You don't. I mean, you gain perspective and you might understand, but it doesn't give you back your childhood.
But you do say that part of what awoke you from that aimlessness that we talked about was seeing the movie version of West Side Story.
Yes, that was quite a moment for me.
Did that also get you thinking about going into show business?
I think probably. I saw this movie that exalted my crummy-looking neighborhood. All of a sudden, the things that I had witnessed all my life looked beautiful on
screen.
And
Rita Moreno as a role model.
As a role model. I mean, that was my mother. My mother was totally into, get the washing machine. This is important.
You applied to the High School of Performing Arts in Manhattan. That had to be a big step for a kid from the neighborhood you grew up in the Bronx.
Right. I didn't even know it existed. That was another teacher who wanted to pave the way for me, and he insisted that I...
He saw something in you?
Yeah, I guess so. And I was very happy with my ambitions of being a secretary. But when I got to performing arts, I realized how... provincial my upbringing had been and how I had a lousy elementary school education.
But you had to audition for it, so you must have had something.
I guess so. I just did whatever he told me to do, which I think was pretty crummy acting, but they still accepted me.
Well, despite the fact that it was a relatively diverse place, you say that it had very few Hispanic students. Why do you think that was?
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of kids in the inner city at that time didn't know about the school, I suppose.
And then you attended college at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Were you just trying to get away?
I was. I wanted to get away from my family, number one. And number two, I needed to go to a school that accepted me on an audition because my grades were so lousy in high school. And Carnegie Mellon and Hofstra University were two universities that were accepting children, young people on auditions.
And it also had a theater program?
Yes. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to be an actor. It was more that I wanted to go to college. And society was on my side at that time, I might add.
But you were the first in your family. Were they shocked that you were going to Pittsburgh to go to school?
Yes, they were.
In your junior year, you became involved in the original off-Broadway production of Godspell in New York. That suddenly must have been the turning point in your life.
It really was because I realized that I could make people laugh, and that was so empowering.
You end the book with your audition for Sesame Street. Wasn't it an unusual audition process?
Yes. for compared to now people who, to how people have to audition nowadays, it was unusual because John Stone, a creator of the show, made the decision all by himself. I went into an office and he told me to tell him a story, and I told him a nightmare I had as a kid, and he liked it, and the next thing I know, I was cast on the show. Nowadays, as you know, it takes 30 people to make the smallest decision about casting.
Everything's a committee, but yes. That probably also allowed you to find yourself and find your character.
Yes, they were very supportive of me. They were very clear that they wanted a real person.
Had you seen the show before you began to work
yes,
on it?
Yes, I saw it at Carnegie Mellon University. I flipped. I saw it in the student union, and there was James Earl Jones reciting the alphabet. I thought it was a show that taught lip reading.
Had you... You thought it taught lip reading?
Yes, because he was very deliberate. A, B, C, as the letters splashed over his head. It was pretty weird.
Some people are critical of the deal with HBO. They argue that privileged children will get to see the show months before everyone else. What are your thoughts
on that? I think that the show has always reflected the times that it exists in. It came out of the 60s and it embraced the 60s and the feminism, and it embraced that too. And we're living in harsh times. They need the money. It would be wonderful if people could do work for kids and not have to worry about making a buck. But that's not the world we live in now.
It'll still be shown on PBS
station.
And
it'll still be shown on PBS station. And they still do outreach programs. And they're going to have the Arabic version of the show in the Middle East. And what other kids show can boast that?
Weren't you married on Sesame Street?
Yes.
Maria married? But you married. It was a real marriage, your husband.
Well, I married my real husband before I married my TV husband. I decided I fell in love and got married and was going to have a baby. And then Maria followed suit. Her pregnancy was much easier than mine, I can tell you that.
Even though you don't talk about it in the book, how did the character Maria develop? Was it something that... was in constant process throughout
yes,
the years?
Constant process. They kept telling me, John Stone and Dulcie Singer kept saying to me, we want real people so that the kids in the Lower East Side and Latino kids can have somebody to relate to. They stress that. It's very hard to be yourself. It's easier to play a character.
And when did they ask you to start writing? Was that fairly early in the process?
That was like I was 5 years into the show. I felt I was contributing as much as I could as an actor. They would ask my opinion on the Latino segments, and I would give my opinion, and they would implement them. So then I felt my work was validated, and then I started writing myself.
And others must have felt it was validated. You've won 15 Emmys.
Yes, as part of the writing staff. It's been a great ride.
And now you've left. Who's going to fill your spot? Are they coming up with somebody else?
No one. They cannot.
Can they ever be another?
There can never be another Maria. Impossible.
Well, but back to West Side Story with Maria, aren't we? I could just, after you leave, I can say I just met the girl named Maria.
That's right.
Meanwhile, we have the book, and you're going to, you said you think you're going to write another book?
I think I'm going to write another book, perhaps, and I like writing picture books. As well. They always take place in the Bronx. I have another one called The Miracle on 133rd Street with Simon & Schuster, which will be released in September.
So those are books for kids.
For kids.
Well, this is an adult book, a very adult book.
Yes.
And if you want to see Sonia, well, Sonia Mazzano will be speaking and signing books at La Casa Azul Bookstore on Saturday, September 12th at 3:30 p.m., and this book, which I think that subtitle, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, tells a lot about your intentions here.
Yes, it's two things. It was misery and wonder at the same time.
Do you think in the end it made you a stronger person, a better person? I've always wondered, because I had a rough childhood, I always wondered whether I would have been a better person if I had been born with a silver spoon in my mouth.
I would have rather have taken an easier way, to tell you the truth, no matter what kind of person it may be. But I think we make the best of what we have.
I should also point out that Sonia will be throwing the first pitch at the Yankee game on Tuesday, September 8th. Her book, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, is published by Scholastic Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
For decades, Steve Jobs was considered a legendary innovator in business and technology, a countercultural figure who'd created one of the biggest and most profitable companies in the world. And books and films about Jobs portray him as a visionary and a genius. But what Alex Gibney's latest documentary reveals is that Jobs was a genius at many other things as well, like manipulating public perceptions about him and his company, while engaging in some unsavory practices both at Apple and in his personal life. The film Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine, opens this Friday at the Landmark Sunshine Plaza, or Lincoln Plaza, I guess.
Both.
Sunshine, the Lincoln Plaza, and appropriately on iTunes. And I'm very pleased that it brings Alex Gibney and Fortune Magazine's Peter Elkind, who's written extensively about Apple, to our show today. Welcome, both of you.
Delighted to be here.
Good to hear.
Alex, one scene that you keep returning to in the film is the outpouring of grief from the public after Steve Jobs died. Why do you think that people felt so connected to him?
It's a question that I can't say I answer definitively, but it's what drove me to make the movie. I think one of the reasons is that he had this genius for understanding how important it was to connect us to these devices, computers and then ultimately these mobile devices and smartphones. And that, I think, and he was the personification of Apple for so long, so that when he was gone, we both were afraid that those products weren't going to keep coming, and we missed the character who had been our guide for so long.
And can you think of any other business leader who people felt a similar connection to?
No.
Peter, Joe Nocera of The New York Times says that whenever he wrote a story critical of Apple, he would get a lot of hate mail. Did that ever happen to you?
Well, I did get some hate mail after I wrote a long story about Steve Jobs, but I mostly got hate from Steve Jobs, and as did my magazine, simply because it dared to assign a writer to write about Steve Jobs who Steve hadn't known and approved.
And Apple would come down hard on the press when it did something that they disapproved of. There's a story of a guy who found a prototype for an iPhone on a bar stool and then wrote about it and wound up being investigated by the police.
More than investigated, he had his door broken down by what you might even think of as a kind of a SWAT team that was part of this multi-jurisdictional investigative force. And this was after he had returned the phone, and they confiscated all of his computers and so forth and so on. So it was a pretty brutal display of power.
A message to journalists, don't mess with us?
I think so.
You say in the film that you were one of those people who had to have an iPhone.
I did. I mean, when it first came out, I remember I got one early, and I took it over to England, and I was showing it around like I had, you know, Frodo's ring or something like that. I mean, it was I really was entranced by it.
I was interested in the early days when it was announced. A lot of news articles said, well, Nokia is ahead, and so many other manufacturers of phones, Magnavox, et cetera, were ahead, and this isn't going to be anything special. And almost immediately, people perceived that it wasn't like everything else.
The iPhone was so engaging, and that was the genius of Steve Jobs, or one of his, you know, enormous talents. He created devices that we felt very personally, that we engaged with, that were user-friendly, that were very comfortable to use.
And Al Gore said Jobs was the first person who created technology products that people loved. I can't believe that's totally true.
Well, I think it is true in part, but I think that, you know, if you look just before the iPhone, I think the really important device was the iPod. And what was genius about the iPod was that it wasn't about a device that you used to listen to music. It said to you, here's a device that holds all of my music. It was an extension of you. And I think that was the philosophy then extended to the iPhone. And that's what made, I think, Steve's products different.
Although these are all extensions of other things. The iPod is an extension of the Walkman.
Sure.
The iPhone is the
But the way he sold it to us was different. I mean, 1,000 songs in your pocket. It was genius that way.
This story has been told many times before, but perhaps we should do a brief recap of Apple history. How did Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak meet?
They were, I think
it was childhood friends.
That's right.
Yeah. Steve Wozniak is a little older. But they met early.
And Steve Wozniak was really the engineering genius.
And their first business venture, one of Jobs' selling points was sticking it to the man. What did he mean by that?
Well, they helped to make blue boxes together. And blue boxes were these devices that allowed you to essentially get on long-distance networks for free at a time when we all had long distance and when it was terribly expensive. It was illegal, mind you, but these were devices that were sticking it to the man.
Peter, hadn't Jobs and Wozniak collaborated on creating games for Atari?
They did. They worked together there, and there's a tale in the film which has been which Wozniak talked about very painfully, where Steve Jobs got paid for doing freelance work, and he said he was
giving, called Breakout.
Yes, and said he was giving Steve Wozniak half the money from it. It turned out that he actually got paid far more than he gave to Steve Wozniak.
And was Wozniak aware of that? Because they kept on collaborating.
He became aware of it, and he described it as being a very painful experience.
Because he said he would have given Steve the money if he wanted it, but the idea that Steve was so dishonest to him that he gave him a small pittance of what it actually deserved, but if it was about the money, he would have given it to him.
You interviewed Bob Belville, the former director of engineering on the Macintosh. What did he have to say about working with Jobs?
Bob Belville maybe is the heart of the film because we asked him to read his sort of personal eulogy for Jobs, and he broke down crying any number of times as he started to read it. And he both felt tremendous affection for Jobs and felt that Jobs had pushed him to his greatest work, and yet he also said that Jobs and the workload cost him his wife and his kids in terms of being driven from them. So he weeps both for his affection for Jobs and at the pain Jobs caused him.
One of the Apple's first Macintosh computers was named Lisa Peter. That's another messy story, isn't it?
It is a messy story. When Jobs had a child out of wedlock with his high school girlfriend, Chris Ann Brennan, named Lisa, and for a very long time he denied paternity of the child. In fact, went so far as to state in court that he was sterile and infertile and incapable of having a child and would pay no child support, and only after got sued by the state. She was on welfare, by the way. She was supporting her child on welfare, his child on welfare, at a point when he's worth $200 million. It's only when after he got sued by the state that he agreed to pay $500 a month in child support.
And it surprised me because he was an adopted child. You would have thought that he would have been more supportive of a child of his own.
You would have thought. But these issues of paternity keep coming back again and again with Steve. And I think the interesting thing about his character as an adopted child is he both felt a really deep-seated anger at having been rejected, but his adopted parents really doted on him, and so he felt both simultaneously angry and entitled, which I think is a key to his character.
Although later he discovered that his sister, the product of his birth parents, is one of America's best writers, so
Mona
he must
Simpson.
Have also felt proud. Did he ever have a relationship with Lisa, his daughter?
He did. Over time, they came to have an relationship. She went and lived with him for a couple of years in high school. And she writes very movingly about their relationship, which had its ups and downs throughout his life in the film.
We're talking about Alex Gibney's latest film, Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine, which opens this Friday at the Landmark Sunshine and the Lincoln Plaza. Alex is here along with Peter Elkind, who has written extensively about Jobs and Apple for Fortune magazine. One of the legends of Apple is that when Jobs came back after starting Pixar and Next, he brought the company back from the dead. Is there truth to that?
Sure. Apple was in bad shape. It was it had a very strong niche following for its computers, but it was not doing well and really required an infusion of money from Bill Gates, of all people, and Microsoft to keep it going.
So it could have gone the way of Betamax?
It is not impossible. It definitely could have, yes.
But
it was doing too many products, and they weren't hitting well.
They were days away from bankruptcy.
But the film also suggests that Fred Anderson played a major role in the comeback.
I think what's true is that there was a team of people who were already at Apple when Steve came back who were a very powerful force, a kind of dream team for allowing the company to come back. So it wasn't just – I think the legend is that Steve came back, he gave the orders, and everything was fine. There was a very strong team in place once Steve came back.
And he recognized it. I mean, he privately worked very hard to preserve that team. He recruited some great people. He brought them over from Next in a couple of cases, several cases. But in public, he was the entire show.
I was wondering why Next didn't make it. Was it an inferior product?
It wasn't. It was a product that was out of tune with the marketplace. It was too expensive, too complicated, and was targeting a very narrow audience.
Didn't Fred Anderson get largely blamed later in the stock backdating scandal at Apple?
Yes.
What happened there?
He did. Steve basically threw him under the bus. He was the CFO of Apple and had done Herculean work in terms of keeping the company alive and then helping turn it around. And he and Nancy Heinen, the general counsel of the company, were the ones who basically took the fall in the stock option backdating scandal. What was extraordinary is that Fred Anderson, when he settled with the SEC on some with a relatively minor fine and charges, issued a statement saying Steve Jobs had been entirely aware of the implications of what they were doing.
And Steve Jobs denied that.
Yes.
And stock backdating is they gave him the stock option and then claimed that they had given it to him earlier when it was a lot cheaper?
That's part of it. It's okay to backdate stock options. It's not okay if you do it and you don't report it properly, because then you're cheating the shareholders of the company.
Why didn't Jobs receive any blame in the end?
It's a good question. We were able, thanks to Peter, to find this videotape of Jobs' video deposition before the SEC. And it's interesting just how conciliatory the SEC is toward Jobs. And I think both the board and the SEC backed off because Jobs was so important and so powerful. That's my view.
Another pivotal moment was the unveiling of the iPhone. You interviewed Andy Grignon, is that his name?
Yes.
Senior manager of the phone. What was his take on it?
In terms of?
What it was going to do well. He decided to leave Apple for Palm.
Oh, yes. Well, Andy's description of his exit interview with Steve is very striking. It's a little bit like an exit interview with Vito Corleone. And because Steve begins to talk about how happy he was to have had him in his family and Apple is a family. But then he said, if you so much as take one member of my family with you, I will personally take you out.
Now, this is not the image that we generally got of Steve Jobs. Was it because the press was handling him with kid gloves?
Well, a lot of it unfolded in private and became known only later. And it is also because he was so skillful at identifying himself with Apple's great products, and people didn't see beyond that.
So when Apple was investigated by Congress for its offshore tax accounts, did Congress find any wrongdoing?
No illegality, but I think what was troubling to Congress was that Apple presented itself so forcefully as an American company and yet managed to shelter most of its income, including its income from its American operations, overseas in Ireland so that it didn't pay any taxes.
How much of the money was offshore?
A lot.
We're talking about
billions and billions of dollars. I mean, that's
the most successful corporation in the world right now. Is
yes,
it?
And Apple's not alone in following this practice. I mean, this is one of those cases where the scandal isn't what's illegal; it's what's legal.
Now, do you think that Apple has become a different company since Steve Jobs died?
Somewhat.
The watch strikes me as a bit of a dud, but is it a success?
Well, I think the jury's out on that at this point. I think Tim Cook has definitely taken Apple in some different directions. He's come out as a gay man himself. He's clearly got more of a social conscience than Steve Jobs did, who had a very limited view of his personal role and a company's role in making the world a better place. So I think Apple's already headed in some different directions that way. Steve Jobs did have some duds, in fairness, but Tim Cook definitely has a different tone at the top.
And one of the other things you deal with in the film is the situation at Foxconn in China, where some workers actually committed suicide. How aware do you think the people at Apple were of the terrible conditions there? They must have gone and visited the plant.
Well, here's the instructive thing about Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs went to Japan a lot. He loved Japan. But even though all of these Apple products are manufactured in China. Steve Jobs didn't go to China once. And it's also instructive in that there was a very interesting Chinese activist who was trying to bring all sorts of tech firms, not just Apple, and make them aware of the environmental damage they were causing and also the unfair labor practices. All of the companies were willing to hear Ma Jun out, all except one. That was Apple. And it was only after Steve Jobs resigned, owing to ill health, that Apple actually engaged with Ma Jun.
So initially, they just ignored it. They didn't react at all to the suicides.
Well, we have a conversation of Steve Jobs reacting to the suicides in a business conversation with Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, and he says he's clearly upset by them. But then he goes on to say, well, actually, as a percentage, it's not that big a deal.
So what do you hope people will come away from your film with, that even our greatest heroes have clay feet?
I think it's more than that. I think that Steve Jobs presided over the creation of machines which have, in fact, changed our lives and have become extensions of ourselves. And I think it's important for us, you know, when these corporations get so big, at times when our governments are withering, you know, that we take account of their values. And number two, that we pay more attention to what these machines are doing to us.
Just one more thing. In the beginning of the film, we see a very young Steve Jobs on camera. He's clearly very shy. I was curious where that clip came from and whether he did change a lot over his life, or was he always the Steve Jobs that we've been talking about?
I think by and large, what changed about Steve is not his character, but that he got more power.
My great thanks to Peter Elkind, who has written about Apple and Steve Jobs for Fortune magazine, and to Alex Gibney, whose latest film is Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine. It opens this Friday at the Landmark Sunshine, the Lincoln Plaza, and also on iTunes. It's been a pleasure having both of you back.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Many people think that when he beat Jimmy Connors in 1975, the great Arthur Ashe was the first African-American tennis player to win Wimbledon. But actually, a woman player came first, Althea Gibson, when she won at Wimbledon and at the U.S. Nationals, what became the U.S. Open, in the 1950s. Ms. Gibson is the subject of a new documentary directed and produced by Rex Miller, and I'm very pleased that he joins us now, along with Leslie Allen, who was an American Tennis Association, Women's Tennis Association, and NCAA champion. American Masters Althea Gibson premieres on PBS in a couple of days, September 4th.
Yes, sir.
Althea was born in South Carolina but moved to Harlem when she was still very young. What was her childhood like?
Althea, yeah, she was a product of sharecropper parents, born in 1927. And what intrigued me so much about the story initially was her story arc from sharecropper parents to 30 years later getting the Wimbledon trophy from the Queen of England.
Wouldn't a poor kid who dropped out of school when she was 12 be a rarity in an elite sport like tennis even today?
Oh, most definitely. But she had the benefit of some mentors who identified her athletic talent at an early age and brought her along through the black tennis circles.
Leslie, it's not as exclusive as it once was, but do you think that tennis can still be a difficult sport for poor inner-city kids to have access to?
I think tennis can be a difficult sport for anyone to have access to because it is quite expensive, and it takes a long time to build a champion, and you have to do it on your own. It doesn't depend on whether or not you have a great physical skill. You also have to have that mental fortitude. And oftentimes you don't know that until someone is much older and you've already invested a lot in them.
The boxer Sugar Ray Robinson was an early mentor for her. How did Althea meet him, and what kind of influence did he have on her, Rex?
Yeah, early on she was playing in the play streets of Manhattan through the Police Athletic League, and one of the caretakers of that program was Buddy Walker, a band leader and saxophone player who identified her talent and introduced her to Sugar Ray, who also saw her talent, and he and his wife mentored her and encouraged her to pursue her athletic talents.
But she wasn't first playing tennis. She was playing other kinds of sports that involved using a racket.
Yeah, she was playing paddle tennis with a shorter racket on a smaller court in the streets right in front of her house.
Leslie, when did you first meet Althea, and what was your impression of her?
Well, Althea was someone that was known to my family. I actually grew up with a picture of her in our house, autographed. I didn't have the typical JFK, Martin Luther King picture in our house. It was Althea Gibson. And the first time that I really dealt and interacted with her was in 1979, I believe. She came to Boston, and four of us, Zena Garrison, Kim Sands, Andrea Buchanan, and myself trained with her. And it was life-changing just to see her, be there with her, and work with her. She said one thing to me, and it changed my whole arc of my career.
What did she say?
She looked at me, and she said, with your wingspan, you need to think about winning WTA Tour events. And I was a late starter in tennis, so I thought, well, maybe if I could get good enough to be in the tournament, that would be okay. And she was like, no, you need to think about winning tournaments. And eventually I did.
She was described as being socially standoffish. Do you think that hurt her career and her prospects?
Not necessarily her career, because she was world champion twice over. But I think tennis at that time was a very snobby sport, whether you were in the black community or the white community, very elitist sport. And, you know, Althea came from humble beginnings, and everybody isn't necessarily accepting of someone who's come from humble beginnings, regardless of how much they've achieved. So that was difficult. And if she was going to go on post her play to, quote, earn a living in the sport, she didn't fit the demographic that was doing that in tennis. So that was, that part was difficult. And let's be clear, she was playing in the era of Emmett Till, the worst segregation in our society, and she was cutting through to play in this very elite white sport. So it was difficult at every turn.
Rex, as you mentioned earlier, two men, Dr. Hubert Eaton and Dr. Robert Johnson, noticed Althea's talent and took her under their wings. Who were they, and how did they change her life?
They, Hubert Eaton and Robert Johnson were two black doctors that lived in Wilmington, North Carolina, in Lynchburg, Virginia, and they saw in her a possible Jackie Robinson to break through the barriers of white tennis, and they brought her down to Wilmington, North Carolina, where she went to high school for 4 years, 18 to 22, because she had skipped school from the age of 12.
But this is the segregated South.
Mm-hmm, segregated South. And during the summertime, she stayed at Dr. Johnson's house in Lynchburg, Virginia. Both of these doctors had backyard tennis courts, and that was really the only place you could play tennis in the South as a black person, because there were no public recreation facilities. So they mentored her. During the summer, she played on the black tennis circuit, the ATA, American Tennis Association, which was founded in 1917 and really represented a parallel tennis universe.
But since she also came from the mean streets of New York, even in that world, wasn't she considered rather rough?
Yeah, the what we know now as sort of the bourgeoisie of black society didn't always take to her rough edges. But Dr. Johnson and Dr. Eaton mentored her and let her know that if you do want to break through, you have to clean up your act a bit.
Did the U.S. Tennis Association have a written ban on black players competing in national competitions?
No. As Dick Savitt, Wimbledon champion, points out in our film, it was more of an unwritten rule that banned people of color. And Alice Marble, who was a world champion at the time, took Althea's case very seriously and wrote an open letter in one of the big tennis magazines that challenged the powers that be to let her into the tournaments.
So she finally was able to play at Forest Hills. What was the reaction of the fans?
Well, some fans obviously appreciated her tennis ability, but there were, you know, shouts of the N-word and that this wasn't
right. And
this
is in New York.
This is in New York City, 1950. But from people that I spoke to, there were a lot of people that just wanted to see good tennis. So I wouldn't say that was a cut across all people.
Her first championship match at Forest Hills in 1950 was very dramatic. can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, she played in the second round. She played the number one player in the country who had won several Wimbledon U.S. titles, Louise Brough. And Althea was about to close out the match deep in the third set. And the match was literally interrupted by thunder and lightning, lightning actually struck one of the cement eagles, literally a 6 or 7 foot cement eagle on the top of the stadium, which toppled off the back of the stadium and everybody had to go home for the day and come back the next day.
Leslie, were you born in 1950 when this happened?
No, I was not born. I was probably, no, I was not born.
So you, by the time you became aware of Althea Gibson, she was already an established player. This is her breakthrough moment.
Yeah, she was a person that I knew had won Wimbledon and the U.S. Open because my mother, Sarah Allen, had played on the ATA circuit as an amateur, and Althea had preceded her winning the ATA championship when she couldn't play in the U.S. Nationals for 10 years in a row, let's say. So Althea's lore was known to anybody that was around the ATA circles. As a kid growing up, I heard she won Wimbledon in the U.S. championships, but I didn't really understand the racism that she had to overcome in order to do that, because the tennis world that I was involved in was just the African-American tennis world and very welcoming. So it wasn't until I was older, starting on the tour, playing in college at USC, that I really understood the largesse of her accomplishment.
Did she talk much about race, Rex?
Well, Althea being that famous, I mean, she was on the cover of Time magazine, Sports Illustrated, New York Times multiple times. And obviously there were going to be people in the civil rights movement who wanted to take advantage of that and have her speak about race issues. But again, this was in the time of Jim Crow, Emmett Till, and this is long before Martin Luther King or Arthur Ashe came on the scene. So it was a very tough and daunting challenge to be able to talk about race. So she preferred to let her racket do the talking. And she always said that, "I just want to be champion. I just want to compete. Just let me be one of you." But in the 50s, that was going to be a difficult thing.
But she was somebody who, as you say, made magazine covers and actually was somebody who perhaps the United States was using for its propaganda, fighting the very bad image that it had around the rest of the world for things like Emmett Till.
Yeah, in 1955, she was asked to go on a State Department tour overseas in Asia, and a lot of people said, "Don't do it, Althea, they're just using you." And she said, "Well, I'm going to go because it's a great opportunity for me, and I'm going to represent my country to the best of my ability and pursue my tennis." And she went, and she won 18 tournaments in a row, which kind of launched her into winning first the French Open and Wimbledon. Because when she first broke through in 1950 and didn't make the championship at Forest Hills, she didn't win Forest Hills or Wimbledon until 1957. So the State Department tour in 55 represented a great opportunity that she eventually took advantage of.
Leslie, do you think that Althea helped to get more African-Americans interested in tennis?
I think because African-Americans were already playing tennis and Althea actually came to it late, it was more of the fact that she was a great champion, because it was still, tennis wasn't universal. It was still seen as a snooty sport. Only some people play, or even African-Americans were told when they were playing tennis, "Oh, you're trying to be white." So it wasn't as accepted in a universal sport like it is today. So only certain, quote, types of people were supposed to be playing tennis in the era of Althea Gibson, unlike today where tennis is, you know, much, much more open.
I'm speaking with Rex Miller, who made a film for American Masters called Althea Gibson. It premieres on PBS September 4th at 9 p.m. And with Leslie Allen, who was an American Tennis Association, Women's Tennis Association, and NCAA champion. Now, how did Althea pay the bills? This is a time when tennis players didn't make very much money.
Yeah, Althea spent her time on the amateur tennis circuit, and she would get by with what was known then as under-the-table expense money. And as Donald Dell, super agent who represented Stan Smith and Michael Jordan, points out, if she was playing today, she'd be making $10 million easily. But at the time, it was amateur, and even after she became world champion, she didn't have a way to make a living, which led to her quitting tennis at the height of her talent and number one in the world to try to go make a living because, as she said, "I may be the queen of tennis, but you can't eat a crown, so I have to go find another way."
So she tried her hand at singing.
She sang. Oh, well, I like to think that the film is also somewhat about her musical life, because she grew up in the cotton fields where blues music comes from. She grew up in Harlem amidst the Harlem Renaissance. Louis Armstrong, folks like this were around her. She eventually cut an album. She sang on the Ed Sullivan Show. She even appeared in a John Wayne film. And she also turned to golf, which she had learned in college at Florida A&M, and became the first black woman on the Ladies Professional Golf Association tour. So she was multi-talented, and on top of all that, she got a four-year degree from Florida A&M. So to me, she makes a great role model for the youth today.
Did she feel like she was given the respect she deserved?
I think that's a big no. Tennis now embraces past champions, and Leslie can talk about this, but she was not asked to come and do exhibitions, and I think partly that was because of her own tending to want to be by herself somewhat, but really, if tennis wanted her to come out, they would have found a way.
Leslie, I heard you chuckle when I asked that question.
Yeah, because I think tennis really turned their back on Althea. And when you are the world champion and the tennis boom of the 70s was happening, if someone sometimes wanted her to be involved, they would offer her a pittance when she would know that her colleagues who had not accomplished what she had accomplished, they were being paid hand over fist. And so she was very proud and had a standard and was not, as she had once told me, I wasn't going to take crumbs when I should get the whole cookie. And so that was very difficult. Tennis did not embrace her once she left the game and once she had stopped playing.
The film also describes the tennis world at the time as being an old boys club, and male players could use their connections to find work when they stopped playing. But she was excluded from that?
Yeah, well, male tennis had a small professional circuit that might only include three or four people touring around the country, playing in a different town every night with the likes of Pancho Gonzalez, Bobby Riggs, Jack Kramer. Althea tried. She had a little bit of an exhibition tour playing these matches with the Harlem Globetrotters. But, yeah, she did not get the Wall Street job opportunities that a lot of these men from Ivy League colleges were offered.
Angela Buxton was her doubles partner and a lifelong friend. What did she tell you about playing with Althea?
Well, Angela had a similar background as Althea, as being somewhat of an outsider, because she grew up Jewish in England during World War II, and then just after World War II, she launched her own career. And even being number one in England at the time, she came across a lot of racism and was excluded from certain clubs. So that led Angela and Althea to become somewhat of a bonded duo, and they played and won the Wimbledon doubles together and then became lifelong friends.
And she helped her later in her life when Althea, I had no idea, was on the verge of suicide because she was destitute. She pretty much couldn't pay the bills. She almost became homeless. I mean, we're talking about one of the greatest. Today, as you pointed out earlier, she would be a millionaire.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it was a matter of Althea felt like she had been a forgotten soul, and only time people wanted to reach out to her was when they wanted something. Give us a comment about the Williams sisters. Can you do this? Can you do this? And she was very proud, and she just did not like that. So at the end of her life, the tennis community realized it, in addition to Angela, and we all sort of came to her rescue to try and help those last days be much more meaningful.
So people in the tennis world sent money to her, much to her surprise, and she was able to live out the last years of her life a little more comfortably than she might have otherwise?
Most definitely.
But I wonder if Serena Williams has to face some of the things that Althea did on and off the court. Both of them have been described as being masculine. Do you see that as coded language?
I think from a lot of times athletic women do get that coded language as being masculine. And I think, you know, when you compare Venus, Serena, or any of the African-American players today to Althea, you have to realize that when Althea was playing, there was institutional racism at every turn. She couldn't stay in the hotel. She couldn't go in the locker room. She couldn't eat in the dining room. She couldn't. And despite that, she still excelled. Yes, in today's world, like any African-American person, you will find some racism here and there. It will crop up. It's expected. So there are challenges that I face, that Venus faced, Serena faced, but they were not nearly the magnitude that Althea faced in tennis. And if that wasn't enough, she went into golf. Hmm. So that is just a remarkable accomplishment from that standpoint.
Rex, we don't have the time to go into this, but you do also spend some time on her her love life, her the rumors that she was a lesbian, her marriage to a man who probably wasn't the best person to have been her husband.
Well, Bill Darbin was the love of her life, as we learn in the film, and he was maybe cut from a different cloth. He was not athletic. He was more of an intellectual, but he was her lifelong friend and soulmate. So I don't know if he wasn't the best person. It didn't. The marriage didn't last, but clearly they had wonderful years together. And with regards to the sexuality...
Well, the reason I said that is because she's destitute at the end, and you would have thought that somebody who loved her would have come through for her.
Well, they divorced many years before the end of her life, and they remained friends towards the end of her life, and he passed before her, actually. And as Angela Buxton points out in the film, that's actually when she really went downhill, after he passed.
So you were saying something else?
Oh, yeah, you brought up the sexuality issue, which, you know, early on in Althea's life, she was described as a tomboy. And we know these days that that's coded language. She's very athletic. She's a tomboy. So she faced those issues her entire life, and they were never really talked about. And a great character in our film, Art Carrington, told me, how can you talk about Althea Gibson and not talk about the whole person? So as he portrays it, he said this was something that quietly traveled behind her. Whether she was or she wasn't, it's a perception that the public put upon her.
And Leslie, is this something that all women who are in sports have to deal with?
Yeah, it is a question. Not so much I find today, but it is a question. And when you think of the 50s, how homophobic the world was then, and you ask, you know, why wasn't Althea being invited to things? Again, like Rex said, whether she was gay or not didn't matter. If there was a whisper of it, the country club is not inviting you in.
Leslie,
you're not going to be invited to come.
Leslie Allen, Rex Miller, thank you so much for talking to us today about it. The American Masters look at Althea Gibson, which premieres on PBS in a few days from now, September 4th at 9 p.m. It's been a pleasure having you both on our show.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.